Okay. I think we have everyone now. First, I want to know, is this the first time for anyone? If it is, I'll just send a quick note at the bottom. Okay, so let me briefly explain how it works. I'll be speaking. You can see me, hopefully. You can talk as well. It might be easier if there's questions or comments to send a little note at the bottom, although I'll be stopping and asking if anyone has questions or comments. I'll also note that all the previous lectures, 11 of them, are now available, I saw, on the website. You can download them. You can listen on the computer, and it really leads us into what we're doing now. So without any further ado, Rabbi Kelman, is it time to begin?
It's time to begin, and I just want to welcome all our newcomers and our returnees, and they're ready for an exciting series, and let's take it away, Dr. Shapiro.
Okay, and again, let me just thank Shalom and Rabbi Kelman for pioneering this new technology and making this all possible. We've discussed a number of important figures in Orthodoxy. This is now the 12th of these lectures, and now we turn to the Satmar Rebbe. Now, originally it was supposed to begin last week, and Rabbi Kelman, I guess, thought that the irony would have been too rich to begin a series on the Satmar Rebbe on Yom HaTzmaot, especially since in the Satmar Rebbe's mind, that is the worst day in the Jewish calendar, even worse than Tisha B'Av, because Tisha B'Av only reflects a past event, whereas, as we'll see, Yom HaTzmaot reflects the continuing minus, the continuing heresy day in and day out. So although we don't have any halachic obligations to fast or anything like that because we don't have Chazal anymore, in terms of the content of the day, Tisha B'Av is only remembering a past tragedy, whereas Yom HaTzmaot, as we'll see, is every year, even every day, but once a year, seeing how terrible it really is, and therefore we decided to push it off one class. Now, there is no apology needed to discuss the Satmar Rebbe, as we'll see, called the Satmar Rav. In fact, right before I came on, I saw on one of the websites, the blogs, which with various postings, they somehow think that all these classes, that is, the people who haven't heard them, that I'm sitting here and you're sitting here going forth in some indoctrination of left-wing modern orthodoxy or something. It's interesting to people who haven't listened to any of them. But certainly, if we're discussing the most important figures of orthodoxy, the Satmar Rebbe has to be included as well, especially considering the fact that the Satmar are the largest Hasidic group in the world today. The estimate, the best estimate, is about 125,000 people who identify as belonging to the Satmar. This is something quite incredible because in 1945, right after the war, I don't believe there were even 100 families who would identify themselves as part of Satmar. And the number grows every year. Every year, Satmar needs to expand its school system, add more classes, because the children, the amount of children they have, is growing exponentially. Every year, there's more and more children. They can't keep them in the classroom, so they're constantly expanding. As you all know, I'm sure, they're centered in Williamsburg, also in Kiryas Yoel, in Monroe, New York. They also can be found, I was in Tucson one winter, and lo and behold, they have a community out there. The Rebbe used to even go there for the winter. And they even have a summer community in New Hampshire, in Bethlehem, New Hampshire. You can see some of their rabbis who sign their letters, Beit Lechem, but it's not Bethlehem as in Israeli Bethlehem, which, as we'll see, they believe it's forbidden to go to. It's Bethlehem, New Hampshire. It's a whole colony up there in the summer. There's a kosher restaurant, and in addition, of course, they're found in London and South Africa and Australia and Vienna and Israel and Bnei Brak and elsewhere. The Rebbe, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, or known by the followers as Rabbi Yoelish, was born in 1888 in the city of Sziget, Hungary. Those who've read Elie Wiesel's book, know he comes from Sziget as well. His father was Rav of the city, and his father also served as a Rebbe there. The Satmar Rebbe dies in 1979. I remember it well because my family was at Grossinger's that weekend. It was actually my birthday, the day he died, or the day of the funeral. I can't recall. And we were on our way back from Grossinger's, and there was a huge backup because you go through the Catskills, you go past Monroe, and they were having the funeral. When he was about 17 years old, the Rebbe moved, as I said, he's from Siget, to Satmar, a city in Transylvania, sometimes Hungary, sometimes Romania. And within a short time, he had attracted a following of sorts. A base medrash was established for him, and he began to function as a Rebbe. What does that mean, to function as a Rebbe? It means that people come ask you for brachas. It means you have a tish Friday night. They take shirayim from you. They begin to come to you to ask you for advice. You are not just a regular person. You stand above them. So he was functioning as a Rebbe already as a young man, 17, 18 years old. He had a following. He served as a rabbi, a rav, in two Hungarian or Romanian cities until 1928. He was appointed, that is, chosen to be rav of the Orthodox community in Satmar. There was a big dispute, a machokas, over his appointment, though, and he did not assume his position until 1934. Until then, he remained in his previous position, which was the city of Krola. Now, in Satmar, as in the previous cities, he established a yeshiva with hundreds of students. Now, Satmar, we called this lecture, and we referred to him as the Satmar Rebbe. But if you ever speak to Satmar Hasidim, they call him the Satmar Rav. And there's a big difference. Unlike other Rebbes, the Satmar was a Rav. He was a communal Rav, Rav of the city. That meant he was also a great Talmud Chacham. As the Rav of the city, he was poskening shilas in all sorts of areas. You never refer to the Gera Rebbe, or the Belzer Rebbe, or the Lubavitcher Rebbe as the Lubavitcher Rav, or the Gera Rav, because they were not Rabbanim. They might have had smicha, but they were not involved in Pesach. In Lubavitch, there was a base to decide it. In Ger, the Ger Rebbes have always been great Talmidei Chachamim, but yet there always were Dayanim deciding these questions, and Bells as well. So you had, in the Hasidic world, you had the Rebbe, and you had the Rav. And the Hasidic world actually downgraded the significance of the Rav. In the Misnagid world, in the non-Hasidic world, the Rav is the center of religious life. He decides the question, he's the spiritual leader, he's the one you go to, he sets the general religious tone. In the Hasidic world, the Rav is a functionary. All he does is decide the shailas, the halacha question. If you want to know if you can do this on Shabbos, you go and you ask the Rav. However, the Rebbe is the spiritual leader. The Rebbe is the important one. The Rebbe is the one who gives drushas. The Rebbe is the one who sets the tone of the community. So in the Hasidic world, the Rav is not an important figure. He is, as I said, a functionary, a technocrat. This is one of the great differences, the innovations of the Hasidic world. The Satmar, though, however, is significant because he was both the Rav and the Rebbe. And that's very unusual. Now, I don't mean to say, by the way, that the Rebbes in the Hasidic movements were, by the standards of today, what we would call Amaratzim. Certainly, the Rebbes of Lubavitch were always learned. The Rebbes of Ger were always learned, the Sfas Emes and many others. However, it does need to be said that, and by the way, let me just say, they wouldn't be Amaratzim, many of these Rebbes, because they sat and learned for 5-6 years before they were married. So they learned, knew something. But by the standards of Torah study that was found in the Lithuanian world and other places of Eastern Europe, there were many Rebbes who were regarded as Amaratzim. Again, they wouldn't be Amaratzim if you put them in your local American Orthodox community today, your modern community. But if you put them in a Lithuanian community, they would be regarded as Amaratzim. But this is one of, as I said, one of the great themes, one of the great innovations of Hasidut. The Rebbe does not need to be a Talmud Chacham. He doesn't need to be a Talmudic scholar. He's a leader in Hashkafa, in ideology. So the fact that you have Rebbes in Poland who were attacked and criticized for not knowing anything, in the eyes of their followers, that was unimportant. If you wanted to know if this was us or a mutter on a Shabbos, a Hilchos Shabbos, or if you want to know how to write a get, you don't go to the Rebbe for that. For the Rebbe is the charismatic personality. The Rebbe is the one who provides spiritual guidance. Satmar, therefore, is very unusual because the Rebbe and the Rav are one and the same. And of course, whenever you have a system based on charismatic leadership and then following that is based on inheritance, the factor of heredity, you're always going to have Rebbes who don't measure up. In Satmar today, There are many who still have loyalty to the Satmar Rav Urgenstig, Rav Yoel, because they thought the successors didn't measure up. And often, there'd be disputes and breakaways over that. In the Hasidic world, the son or the son-in-law is chosen. And if you ask them how that's possible, let's say the son doesn't know anything, let's say the son doesn't have the charisma, they will tell you it's like a sacrifice. You can take a one-day-old carbon, and you can make it holy. The Rebbe is holy from birth. But obviously, when you have a situation like that, you're not going to have the same quality all the time that you will when people are chosen because of their knowledge. Now, parenthetically, let me state that the non-Hasidic world has actually adopted from the Hasidic world two important things. First of all, the role of the Rosh Yeshiva today very much parallels that of the Hasidic Rebbe. For example, the Rosh Yeshiva is very central. They have what's known as Das Torah, that is their intuitive knowledge, and allows them to make decisions on all sorts of things that in previous years only Hasidic Rebbes would decide. They give brachos, miracle stories are told about them, they even have shirayim, some of these Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Yashiv, there was a thing in one of the Haredi newspapers about how people were taking shirayim. Shirayim are these little pieces of food that Hasidim grab after the Rebbe finishes eating it. Non-Hasidim will see it as disgusting, perhaps, but they think there's some sort of holiness that they can imbibe from that. In addition, the role of the Rav has been very much devalued in non-Hasidic society. Everyone who knows anything about the Lithuanian world knows that today the Rav really doesn't have the power they used to. The Rosh Yeshiva are setting the tone, so those are differences. And also, of course, in the Yeshiva world as a whole, they've adopted the hereditary model. A Rosh Yeshiva is succeeded by his son or son-in-law. Unlike in places like Yeshiva University or in Torah Vadas, in which these are communal institutions, these are public trusts, in which a board picks the Rosh Yeshiva, in places like Tells and Lakewood, it goes to the son, which creates problems, because if the son is not such a Talmud Chacham, you don't have such a great faculty, people won't come, and they say that Tells now is pretty much empty. Lakewood obviously is not what it used to be. So the Lithuanian model is really like the Hasidic model, and that it goes to the children. He doesn't even do weddings anymore. Yeah, they come, they'll stay for a little bit, and then they'll leave, they'll sit in the corner, you're supposed to approach them. There have been some Rosh Yeshiva who are very much opposed to this, but others see this as Kavod HaTorah, as raising the stature. And as I said, getting back to the quality of the institution declines when you get to the yeshivas. Hasidus has, of course, influenced the general non-Hasidic world just in terms of dress. In the last 30 years, the yeshiva world has bought into a uniform, just like the Hasidic world has always had a uniform, the black and the white, whatever it was, although it's interesting because Gemara says that the only people, black is the bad color. It says that if you want to do a sin, wear black and go where no one knows you. But for some reason, in the Hasidic world, black is the color, although the Rebbe on Shabbos doesn't wear black. He wears all sorts of interesting colors. In the last 30 years, the yeshiva world has also adopted a uniform, as you all know, of a white shirt, black pants, which is due to Hasidic influence and the need to have a uniform. Okay, let's go on then. So we see that the Satmar Rav is significant in that he's a great Talmud Chacham and serves as a communal Rav and was deciding Jewish law on a daily basis. Since he is called the Satmar Rav, though, people often think that he was the Rav of the city of Satmar. I will tell you also, Satmar comes from the word Satu Mari. You'll see repeated all the time that this means Saint Mary, and that people make all sorts of comments on the irony of a Hasidic Rebbe being Rav of a city called Saint Mary, but it's not true. Satmari in Romanian means small village, or large village, small village, or large village, I forget, one or the other. So it doesn't have anything to do with St. Mary. No, they didn't wear black pants and white shirt or anything, they just wore in Belushin. They wore whatever the people were wearing at the time. It turns out, it so happens that a lot of people probably just wore black, but it wasn't a uniform. I can even tell you that 30 years ago in Lakewood, no two hats were the same. Look at the pictures of all the great Lithuanian yeshivas from before World War II, And everyone, you've all seen the pictures, they're wearing caps, they're wearing white. White was very yeshivish. Only the Rosh Yeshiva wore black. We don't have any pictures in Volozhin, but there wasn't any dress code. So whatever the peasant boys wore, that's what they wore in the yeshiva. Only the Rosh Yeshiva wore rabbinic garb, rabbinic dress. And it got to be the point that even some in the 20th century, for example, at YU, none of the Rosh Yeshiva ever wore rabbinic garb except for Rav David Lifshitz, the long coat. None of them did. And you have other yeshivas where the Rosh Yeshiva did not wear the rabbinic garb. Sometimes they would wear it on Shabbos. But today, all the Rosh Yeshiva will wear the rabbinic garb and all the students as well. As I said, this notion that the Satmar Rav was the Rav of the city is actually incorrect. He was the Rav of the Orthodox Kehila, the Orthodox community in Satmar. But this means something very different in Hungary than it meant in Germany. In the mid-19th century, there was a great dispute in Hungary over between Orthodox and Reform, the repercussions of which were even greater than what happened in Germany. There was this conference in the mid-19th century. The Orthodox could not agree with the Reform. The Orthodox got together. They were not called Orthodox then. And they determined, they passed a series of takanot, of rulings, that all Torah true Jews must join an Orthodox kehila. They are going to open up Orthodox kehilots in every city. And every Orthodox kehila and every must join the National Organization of Orthodox Kehilot. And that's what's going to determine if you're Orthodox. It has an individual, you belong to an Orthodox, a community that's called Orthodox. And if as a group, your community, your shul or your town allies itself formally with an organization based in Budapest, which has all sorts of, has a constitution and rules, claiming they are the Orthodox. The opponents, the reformers, called themselves the Neologues, although I'll tell you that the Neologues were not reform like in Germany or like we think of today. They basically were perhaps a right-wing conservative. There was no mixed seating. There was an organ in many of them, but that's it. The synagogue service was the same. The prayer book was the same for the most part. And many of them, the rabbis, were completely observant. There were other kehilas, though. You have the Orthodox, and you have the Neologue, which are the majority. And then there are other kehilas which didn't want anything to do with this argument, with this machlokas. They simply wanted to continue living as they always had, a Shomrei Torah mitzvahs community, where the rabbi's from and the people are from, but they didn't want to have any involvement with this new organization to take orders from people in the capital, to be told what to do. They just wanted to be general communities. No, it's not like Rav Bamberg, as we'll see. It's different. We're not talking about kehilas here who were not Orthodox. On the contrary, these kehilas, which called themselves the status quo kehilas, because they wanted to keep things going the way they were from up until the time in the mid-19th century that this new organization was formed, they all declared that they have complete loyalty to the Shulchan Aruch. But they didn't want to take a political step of joining together with the so-called Orthodox. And there were some of these status quo communities that had minor reforms, like some of them wanted choirs, others wanted to move the bima to the front, but nothing against the Shulchan Aruch, and many of them were the exact same as every other Orthodox kehila. The parallel would be if a group of rabbanim got together, let's say in Toronto, and declared that every synagogue that wants to be regarded as Torah true must join in our organization, call it the Aguda, let's say. And if you don't, even if you are conducted completely in accordance with Jewish law, you are not to be regarded as Torah true. And what that meant was your rabbi is now pusel, your shochet is invalid, it's forbidden to step foot in your community, you're regarded as an outcast. That's what the Orthodox declared. The status quo communities, who were regarded by the Orthodox as complete outcasts, were always about 10% of the communities in Hungary. In fact, the enmity for the Orthodox, for the status quo, was even more than it was for the reformers. Because the status quo were not just regarded as opponents, they were regarded as traitors, people who had abandoned the fight. Instead of joining with the Orthodox in their political organization, They chose to stay out of it because either because they didn't want the fanaticism. You should know that some Hasidic groups, communities, became status quo because they didn't want to be in an organization in which Rabbanim, especially Rabbanim who were not Hasidim, were telling them what to do. They had their Rebbe. They didn't need any overarching organization. Understand, though, that to be a Rav in a status quo community, if they let you go, you could not get a job in any of the Orthodox communities. You had no relationship with your fellow rabbis. If you're a shochet, you're completely pusle. And no one who was Orthodox would step foot or daven in a status quo shul. It was regarded as just like reform. Now, Hirsch, incidentally, couldn't understand this. We all know Hirsch. We had classes on him. Those who haven't, you might want to listen to them as well, in which we speak about his separatists. Hirsch was the leader of the separatist orthodoxy in Germany. But Hirsch was opposing the reformers. Hirsch actually wrote a letter supporting the status quo rabbis in Hungary because he said, I understand why you can't be in an organization that has reform rabbis. But why does a community that's completely Torah true, halakhically observant, need to join a political organization? It might be a good idea, but how can you say that these people are apostle and they're not Torah true Jews simply because they don't want to join a political organization? So Hirsch, ironically, some might think, defended the status quo, but it's really not irony, because Hirsch was never interested in the politics. He didn't want to have any involvement with reformers. Okay, any questions? By the way, for background on all this, this fascinating group called Status Quo that remained until World War II, you could see this book by Jacob Katz called An Unhealed Breach. It was his last book. It's called Orthodoxy and Schism in 19th Century Central European Jewry, but it really only focuses on Hungary. The last chapter deals with Orthodoxy, but the rest of the book is Hungary. By the way, I will tell you for the Hirschians, for Hirsch, though, he had this anger not just against the reformers, but against the Orthodox that allied with the reformers, he thought, that remained in one community. So in Frankfurt, he claimed that the shul of the Gemeinde, of the General Orthodox, whose rabbi was Rav Mordechai Horowitz, the author of the Tshuvot Matei Levi, a great Talmud Chacham, probably a greater Talmud Chacham than Hirsch, that was forbidden territory, his shul. Hirsch refused to be in the same company as Horowitz. The shul was put in cherem. You could not step foot in the shul. But that's because Horowitz had crossed the line. He refused to separate from the reformers. But the status quo had nothing to do with the reformers. They were just simple Jews who didn't want anything to do with any of the machlokes involved. The first Rav of the Satmar Orthodox community was Rav Yehuda Greenwald, a great Gaon and author of the Zichron Yehuda. That comes about in 1898, because until 1898, everyone was Orthodox in Satmar, and then the status quo community forms. So whereas before you had one community, beginning in 1898, you have a status quo community and what we can call the Orthodox community. Now, the Orthodox community was led by this Yehuda Greenwald, great Talmud Chacham, author of the Tshuvos Zichron Yehuda. He was a student of the Ksav Sofer. He was followed by Rav Eliezer Greenwald, no relation to Yehuda Greenwald, who wrote the Tshuvos Keren LeDavid, also, I believe, a student of the Ksav Sofer. His Sefer, incidentally, Rav Yehuda Greenwald's Sefer, Kol Yehuda, is of significance for bibliophiles because it's an important collection of Tshuvos from Hungarian Rabbanim, but when it was published, it turns out that the Aguda had some connection to the printer, and they bribed the printer, and they're an tshuva. If you look in the table of contents, it describes a certain tshuva that's against the Aguda. But if you look inside, it's not the tshuva is not found there. They bribed the printer to take it out, and there's an article years ago, tshuvot that have been censored, a current interest of mine, and they were able to get the tshuva censored, and it wasn't actually printed until the 1950s in Sinai, the Torah Journal. It finally was printed, and now they've when they republished the Sefer, they put it back in. As to why the Hungarians would oppose the Aguda, we'll see that in a minute. In the status quo section of Satmar, there was also a great Talmud Chacham known as Rav Yitzchak Klein, a student of the Shevet Sofer. The way it works is you have the Chassam Sofer, the first one, the great Chassam Sofer. His son is known as the Ksav Sofer, who Rav Eliezer Greenwald was a student. And then comes his son, the Shevet Sofer, or Simcha Bunim Sofer, and he actually had a son called the Das Sofer, Rabbi Akiva Sofer. Yaakov Katz was a student, but a lot of people didn't like this Das Sofer, and there was a joke that you have the Chosim Sofer, the Ksav Sofer, the Shevet Sofer, and then comes the Tau Sofer. Tau Sofer, for, it means a printer's error. Yes, yeah, so someone know about the Tau Sofer, but he also was a Talmud Chacham. So you have here Yitzhak Klein, the Rav of the status quo community. Oh, the Dor Ravi goes through another line. The Dor Ravi, Rav Glasner, the fourth generation of the Chassam Sofer, through one of the daughters, he becomes the focus of another great Machokas in Hungary. He was in Cluj, in Kleisenberg, because he was a descendant of the Chassam Sofer, a brilliant thinker, but he was a Zionist. And his community, which was an Orthodox community, decides to break away from him and form a separatist community because they couldn't deal with the Zionism of the Dor Ravi. So this Rav Yitzhak Klein was, as I said, a student of the Shevet Sofer, a great Talmud Chacham, dying of the status quo community for 40 years, martyred in the Holocaust. He published two Torah journals, one called Ohel Yitzhak, and one called Hamagid. But other than the status quo rabbis, if you look at it, and they're both available online, they go on for about 20 years, you will find no rabbanim from Hungary writing in these Torah journals. And I can tell you that Rabbi Yoel, when he was in Satmar, would never dare step foot in the same room as Rabbi Yitzhak Klein, whom he would regard as not bikaris. These Torah journals are fascinating, because you have Torah articles there by Gedolim, great Talmidei Chachamim from Poland, from Germany, from Romania, from Lita, from Russia, all the great Torah scholars are writing for it, but no Torah scholars in Hungary. Because whereas the Torah scholars outside of Hungary regarded Rav Yitzhak Klein as a great Talmid Chacham, in Hungary he was regarded as a Parish Min HaTzibur, one who separates from the community, who has to be shunned, and really an apikoros in many of their eyes. When these rabbis published Sfarim, Klein and others published Sfarim, look at the Haskamas. The Haskamas are either all from rabbis outside of Hungary or from other status quo Hungarian rabbis. So I can tell you it was very lonely to be a status quo rabbi in Hungary. You had no colleagues. You had no one to talk to in Hungary. They were such a minority. But many of these people really were idealists, and they thought that they're not going to be forced into belonging to these larger organizations. Now, during the Holocaust, the Satmar Rav, as I said, he functioned as a Rav. There's nothing really significant about him in the years before World War II. He was very much overshadowed by another figure we'll speak about in a few minutes, called the Munkacsa Rav, Munkacsa Revi. He had his yeshiva there in Hungary, which had a few hundred. He, as I said, he wrote things, but he wasn't such a significant figure. He was just a figure, another one of these. Hungary was full of Rebbes and Rabbanim. He wasn't, I won't say that he was an insignificant figure, but he wasn't one of the top two or three. He was one of those rescued. The war came later to Hungary, and many Jews in the capital area certainly survived the Holocaust. The war came later to Hungary, 1944, the deportations start. Many Jews were killed, but many were saved. But in the area that the Satmar Rebbe was from, the Jews were deported. He, however, was saved. Whereas all his Hasidim were deported and almost all of them were killed in that area, he was rescued by Rudolf Kastner. Rudolf Kastner was a Zionist who organized with Eichmann a transport. There was negotiations going on at the end of the war. They knew that the war was lost. People were trying to make deals for themselves, including Eichmann, trade Jews either for money or for they wanted to get the Allies involved, and people were trying to do everything they can to try to make some sort of private deal. Rudolf Kastner had negotiated with Eichmann. He traveled to Istanbul. Yoel Braun traveled to Istanbul on his behalf. Kastner himself traveled to Germany twice in the 1940s, and finally the deal was worked out. The figure usually given is that for they would save a Jew for $2,000. So for every $2,000, they would save one Jew. American Jewry and English Jewry was forbidden, according to regulations, transferring money to the Germans. We can understand why. We wouldn't want them buying planes and all sorts of things and weapons. Germany was willing to make these deals, and they promised that they would use all of the things, the money, and if they were given trucks and things of that nature, only on the Eastern Front. But it was still against the law. However, through Switzerland, money passed hands, and money was given to various Nazi figures, Eichmann in particular. And we do know that despite the embargo, money was sent from America to Switzerland, which then could be used to ransom Jews. Kastner chose the Satmar Rebbe. In addition, he had 1,600 places, one train, and the Satmar Rebbe was one of those he chose. Why he chose the Satmar Rebbe? The irony is incredible. This great anti-Zionist figure is saved by a Zionist leader. In Satmar legend, it says that Kastner's mother appeared to him in a dream and told him who to take. In any event, the Rebbe was placed on this train. He traveled with everyone else on this train. First they went to Bergen-Belsen, but they were with the train. They might have gotten off, I don't know. But then they were quickly on their way to Switzerland, and from there he made his way to the land of Israel. Now the Satmar obviously see this as a great miracle. It's hard to know what to make of this. There are some rebbes and rabbis who had a chance to leave and chose to stay with their flock and martyr themselves or be martyred along the lines of a captain doesn't go down with their ship. On the other hand, we have figures, rebbes and rabbis, or certainly rebbes, who were given the opportunity to leave. They had Hasidim, who it was more important for Hasidim that the Rebbe survive, Hasidim who gave all their money to save the Rebbe, and who took advantage of this and who left, with the Hasidim dying. One of the most famous cases is the Belzer Rebbe. The Belzer Rebbe left. Basically, all of his Hasidim were killed. He was able to get out. There's a picture of him right after he reaches the land of Israel, when he doesn't have a beard. He was going incognito. There's tons of money used for bribery. It was a really miraculous rescue. There's been books written on it. However, he left, and everyone else remained. In fact, talking about censorship, there's another famous example here, because before the Rebbe left, he was in Hungary at this time. His brother, who was another, not a Rebbe, but a big Rav, gave a drusha sermon speaking for the Rebbe to the community and telling them, don't be afraid that the Rebbe's leaving you. The Rebbe's not leaving because the Nazis are coming. The Nazis are not coming to Hungary. There are no Zionists in Hungary. You know, Zionism is not important in Hungary, and therefore there will be no problems in Hungary. And that was the parting wish of the Belzer Rebbe. Don't think I'm leaving because I want to get away from the danger. Of course, we all know what happened. The Nazis came in, the Holocaust began, and so many of these Jews were killed. When this drusha was reprinted years later, this whole section was taken out. It's obviously very embarrassing to read it today. I have a copy, though, of the original drusha, which has this whole section. In fact, it is it's printed in enlarged print. So the Gera Rebbe is another one who got out. I'm not here to make a judgment or anything. It's possible that in such circumstances it's every man for himself, but you should be aware that there were rabbis and rebbes who had a very different view of these Hasidish rebbes and believed that they had to stay with their people. Okay, if those who are further interested, you can read Ben Hecht's Perfidy. He has a great deal there about Rudolf Kastner, who later is assassinated. He has a whole libel trial. Rudolf Kastner was accused of, this is very big in Israel in the early years, he was accused of collaborating with the Nazis, and he was found guilty. He lost the first libel trial when he sued this person, and then he was found, the second one, which was posthumous, I believe, because he had already been assassinated, the court found for him. It's a whole event. Tom Segev, in his book The Seventh Million, discusses it also. Yes, Lawrence Kaplan, in his book on Das Torah, I believe he begins his article with this famous story about the Belzer Rebbe leaving. Question. Send your question over. Hungary is full of, we're asking why there's such extremism in Hungary. I found a tshuva, actually, from, I forget who it is now, some 16th century posse who says that the Hungarians are all fanatics. Why the Hungarians are such fanatics, I don't have an answer. I once even asked my teacher, Professor Tursky, how come all these fanatics, these extremists in Hungary, and you haven't seen anything yet? He didn't have an answer either. Fanaticism breeds fanaticism, perhaps. It got to the point in Hungary that the extremist students of the Chasam Sofer actually condemned the Kassab Sofer for instituting a German preacher. So I don't know why, but there's no question that the most extreme fanaticism is found in Hungary, and also extreme reform also. You had very extreme reform elements in Hungary, not neologue, really extreme reformist elements. So I don't know the answer to that. The Rebbe, as I said, he comes to Israel. It's actually Palestine. He only stays there for a year, and then he goes to the United States, settling in Brooklyn. He comes to Brooklyn with nothing, no followers. Someone told me that he recalled the Satmar Rebbe having to wait outside and try to, and Williamsburg in those days was not a Hasidic, yeah, Tar Vadas was there, he had all sorts of Jews living in Williamsburg. He would wait outside shul, trying to drag people in to make his minyan. He had nothing, nobody. David Halivni, in his autobiography, his memoir, he discusses his first meeting with the Satmar of Satmar Rebbe when he was in Chaim Berlin. The Satmar Rebbe was actually living in Chaim, Rufutner put him up for a little bit, so you can read that if you're interested. In the late 1940s, and even into the 1950s, Jews, Hasidim, begin coming from Hungary, those who survived, to the United States. There was actually Jewish life in Hungary, at least until the revolution, and there was emigration. You had Torah scholars and Torah works published in Hungary after World War II, and many people thought that they could reconstitute Jewish life in Hungary. These Hasidim begin coming to the United States in the late 40s and 1950s, and hardly any of them have any connection to Satmar. Most of the people connected to Satmar were killed. However, these are Hasidim who don't have a Rebbe anymore. Either they survived and their Rebbe was killed, or there is no Rebbe, or now they're in a new environment, but they have these Hungarian extremist ideologies, and they're looking for, and they come to Brooklyn, and they're looking for a Rebbe. They're looking for someone that could be their leader, and they become attracted to Satmar, and think of it. In 1948, 50, when they start coming, there's only maybe 100 families in the world who still have allegiance to Satmar, and all these Hungarians come. In Hungary, there was all sorts of small Hasidic Rebbes, little courts of 30, 40 Rebbes, 40 families, I mean, groups you've never heard of. I've never heard of them. Now, they come to America, and this dominant personality, Satmar Rebbe, they give him their allegiance, and look what 50 years brings. I mean, we still have tiny groups today. I just saw the other day, I was reading a paper, and it mentioned some Hasidic Rebbe who I never heard of. Some of them have no Hasidim. Although that raises the question, you can't be a teacher, I guess, without students. How can you be a Rebbe without Hasidim? But you have tiny Rebbes with 5, 10 family following them. But the Satmar Rebbe takes these people and begins to grow. Why did they go to him? Because he was well known from before the war. And they're coming here and they don't have a Rebbe, so they decide to go to the Satmar Rebbe. There were some who were not complete followers, fellow travelers, as it were, people who went to him but didn't completely buy into everything, but they sent their children to his school, and the children became full-blooded Satmar. So it began to grow. In addition, and this is what's most important, he was the only figure of any significance in 1948 standing up for the anti-Zionist ideals that were so important in Hungary. In May 1948, he wrote in a letter, we have his collected letters, that all the American rabbis had sold out to Zionism, and he's including the Hungarian rabbis. What does that mean, sold out? A lot of these Hungarian rabbis had to make money, so they became rabbis and shuls. Well, when they became rabbis and shuls, these were Zionists, people in the communities were Zionists, or they were Agudists, or something like that, and therefore they couldn't preach anti-Zionism, they went along with it. In fact, I hear we have someone from Passaic. Apparently, Rabbi Jacobson in Passaic, he has a big time of Alchem. He's a Satmar, but someone said to me, how could he be? You can't be a public Satmar because your community is not Satmar. But according to the Satmar Rebbe, they had all sold out. He was the only one publicly condemning Zionism. He wrote in this letter, I have become an object of scorn and contempt, which is exactly true. He was not only was he the only one standing up against Zionism, he was the only one of the Hungarian rabbis standing up against Das Torah, against the Aguda philosophy. The Aguda has this notion that their rabbis can tell you what the Torah truth is, and the Satmar Rebbe was saying, this is all phony, it's a fraud. The greatest opponent of Das Torah is not the modern Orthodox. It's the Satmar Rebbe and Hungarians, because the modern Orthodox don't buy into the whole thing. The Satmar believe that the Rebbe has authority over matters of not directly related to Jewish law, but his point was that the Aguda rabbis are all frauds. This is all a fraudulent philosophy they're putting out. And the Satmar are very proud of this, and the modern Orthodox learned something from this. The Satmar don't care that you tell them, well, that a Aguda person says, well, we have all these Gedolim. As far as the Satmar is concerned, all they need is one, since their one speaks the truth. It's like I heard from my father, Abraham Lincoln used to say, he'd have a meeting, and he'd take a vote, and maybe 10 people of his ten members of the cabinet would vote one way, and he would vote the other. They'd vote no, and he'd vote yes, and he'd say the yeses have it. You know, because if I'm the boss, if I'm one, I'm in the majority. So the Satmar stood up against the Das Torah and stood up against Zionism. There again, Das Torah means, when you use the expression Das Torah, it only means Lithuanian Das Torah. The Hasidim have always believed that the Rebbe has powers of intuition. So they don't use the word Das Torah. They believe that the Rebbe is a prophet even, and that you follow him. Das Torah is a concept invented by the Litvisha world. The Rebbes don't have Das Torah, because Das Torah in the Litvisha world only comes out of learning Talmud and Shas. You get this intuition. For the Hasidic world, it comes upon you magically because of your connection to the dynasty, to the mystical teachings. Das Torah means that out of your study of the Talmud, you get knowledge. So the Hasidim don't have Das Torah. And the biggest proof for the Satmar Rebbe that this is all a fraud, this Das Torah, is that they capitulated, and they're supporting the heresy, as we'll see in a minute. So of course the Hasidim believe that their Rebbe has an idea of, that can tell them all sorts of things. But it's not Das Torah. It doesn't come out of study of Torah. It's a mystical idea, comes out of Kabbalah, comes out of their being in the path of the Rebbe. Remember, for the Hasidic world, the Rebbe is consecrated from birth. Like the Karlin Stolen Rebbe, when he was born, he was made Rebbe because there wasn't any Rebbe. And then there was a regent, to use another term, who was the regent until he was about 18. And then he took over as the Rebbe. But they're consecrated from birth. In the Lithuanian world, Das Torah is something that you earn. So it's a very different concept. So getting back to the Rebbe, it's understandable that there was such scorn and such contempt for the Rebbe. When I say scorn and contempt, he was mocked. He was made an object of ridicule. But for good reason, in the opponent's mind. After the Holocaust, what was there for Jews to live for? The state of Israel assumed such an important thing. It was the most important thing Jews could do. And here, this Hungarian rabbi, who had been saved by Zionists, was declaring that the state was a heresy, that Zionism is heresy. Say what you will about the Satmar Rav, he was an Ish Emet, a man of truth, of which there are very few. He could not be bought. His mind cannot be twisted. He spoke the truth no matter what the consequences, and he suffered greatly for it. Who can think of anyone with such, we'll see with Moshe Feinstein, he's similar. We already saw, though, with Rabbi Weinberg, he was afraid to speak his mind in certain areas. And many Gedolim, Rav Herzog, he wouldn't stand up against the Haredim. The Satmar Rebbe had no fear. If I'm left with just a minion, that's fine, because the truth is not counted in numbers, he said. No, he maintained no relationship with Kastner. In the Satmar books, they say that he was thankful from an individual perspective. But the people, who, as far as I know, he had no relationship with Kastner, other than being thankful that Kastner saved him. Of course, this had nothing to do with Zionism, his being saved. From the Rebbe's perspective, as we'll see, the Zionists were in league with the Nazis to kill the Jews, or to cause the Jews problems. Was he afraid of the Haredim, or did he value? I think it's both. He certainly valued Shalom, but he was afraid that to go up against them, as the Rav was afraid, to go up against them, it would create machlokas. And so there is an element of Shalom, but I think he was afraid of creating machlokas. I mean, I don't know. All I would say is that the Satmar Rav would say, I'm not afraid of creating machlokas because the truth is the truth and it must stand and let there be machlokas. I can say, I guess, the Rav Herzog didn't feel strongly enough in his position to split the Torah world, whereas the Satmar Rebbe didn't care because he didn't see things in shades. For him, everything was absolutely true or false, as we'll see. And as I said, this stance of complete truthfulness, of not backing down, led to a creation of a chassidus of about 125,000 and growing every year. Now, the success is incredible, not just his success, but the post-war success of chassidus in general. Who would have thought that in the United States, chassidut, an extremist chassidut, could flourish? I know that the Rav, for instance, we have the Rav on tape, speaking about how there will never be chassidus in America. And someone in the audience gets up and says, no, there is chassidus. This is from the 70s. And he says, and the Rav shoots him down and he makes fun of him, say, you don't know chassidus. I saw real chassidus in Warsaw, in Europe, etc. And the Rav was wrong, because real chassidus did survive and it's going strong in America. Now, if the United States was like in the 1950s, it would have been harder for chassidus to prosper. But today, in a multicultural environment, chassidus just fits in. It's one more element in the collage. Not a melting pot anymore, the collage. Now, the fact that Satmar, the most extreme of all the chassidus, has been able to thrive in the post-war years, much larger than any of the other chassidic groups, is probably or perhaps the most incredible post-war Jewish story. That a group could come from maybe 100 families in the world and just a few families in America and become what it is today. Show me any other. I mean, people talk about the yeshivas, the great growth of the yeshivas, the greatest success story. It's true, the yeshivas had to have enormous growth. But I don't know of anything that has growth like Satmar. Take all the Chabad houses all over the world. Just look at what Satmar had achieved in a short period. Now, because of his great influence over such a large segment of what we call Orthodoxy, he's very important, and we have to regard him as one of the most important figures in post-war Orthodoxy. I think that everyone listening on this tape will see that as unfortunate. It's a shame that he was so important. He could have done what other Hasidim, take a look at Belz. Belz was anti-Zionist before the war. Lubavitch was anti-Zionist before the war. But after the war, after the state was established, they pulled their followers in a different direction. There were a few Belzers and a few Lubavitchers who weren't happy, so they left and they went to Satmar. But for the most part, and we could say that it's unfortunate that the Rebbe continued his path. However, that's not perhaps for us to judge, and although we might think that Torah Judaism would have been a lot better had he chosen a different path. I mean, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, in my conversation with Rav Aaron, that I'll speak about today, I had one very, very long conversation with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in which I asked him many, many questions. A friend of mine, Rabbi Lopatin from Chicago, who's a student, a co-student, brought me into him. And we spoke about many things, as I'll mention a few I mentioned already in the past. He said that the Rebbe made a blunder. But, I mean, it wasn't a blunder. I mean, that was his position. I think we could say it's unfortunate. The hatred between Lubavitch and Satmar only emerges with Rav Menachem Mendel. And, first of all, his adoption of what's not really Zionism, because they're not Zionists, but what appeared to the Rebbe is Zionism. And he's just general changing the path. I'll speak perhaps a little bit today about that. But understand that the Satmar Rebbe remained friends with the Lubavitch Rebbe. He opposed him, but but they remained friends. And they had a decent personal relationship. And he went to the shiva of the Lubavitch Rebbe. Unlike, for example, Rav Aaron Cutler, who couldn't stand the Rebbe and thought the whole Lubavitch movement was a disaster, and the Rav Elbel Soloveitchik. The Satmar Rebbe still, maybe because, you know, kings always have sympathy for other kings, he still had a relationship. But among the individuals, the people, they developed a certain hatred from Satmar to Lubavitch. Getting back to what I was speaking about, we might think that Torah Judaism would be better, but we can't ignore his importance. I will even say that this has a halachic implication. If you look in Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, the third volume of his Sefer, he's the grandson of Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, an important figure in America, Psak, we'll speak about him in three classes from now. He has a tshuva. Someone asked him an interesting question. Do we have to give, not only do we have to give the Satmar Rebbe kavod, respect, maybe we should degrade the Satmar Rebbe. Maybe we should treat him as a wicked person. What's the basis of the question? Well, if you look in the Gemara says, what's a heretic? What's the definition of a heretic? It doesn't say if you deny the 13 principles or this or that. It says one who is mevaza, one who degrades Torah scholars. One who treats Torah scholars with contempt shows that he doesn't value Torah and that he is to be treated as a heretic. His theology can be perfect, but he's to be regarded as a heretic. We can't count him in a minyan. We can't bury him in the cemetery. We treat him as outside the fold. And this is recorded as halacha in the Rambam. And so in my conversation with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, I asked him about this. I actually was a little mischievous because he was a great follower of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, not in the sense that he was a chassid, but the Rav Aaron thought the Lubavitcher Rebbe was, you know, one of the gedolim of the generation, just like Rav Soloveitchik did. So I asked Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, why don't we put Rav Shach in Chayram and declare that he's not Bikoros? So, of course, Rav Aaron was a little taken aback, and I said, according to the Pesach of the Rambam, he's degrading a great Torah scholar, he's degrading the Lubavitcher Rebbe, therefore he has the status of an apikoros, and we should put him in Chayram. So Rav Aaron explained, of course, what could he say? That today we can't do that. And of course, if we start putting every rabbi in Chayram and treating him like an apikoros who degrades another rabbi, in Ladav Asof, I mean, Rabbi Kalman could speak about Toronto. Half the rabbis will be in Chayram either on this side or the other side, because either the rabbi you support has been degraded, in which case you have to judge the other rabbi as an apikoros, and then they have to judge you. There's no end to it. They would, so Rav Aaron said, today we can't put these people because everyone, you know, there's no end to it. Although when I asked about the Debrett Senior, I said, well, what about the Debrett Senior, the famous Debrett Senior Rav, who writes terrible things about Rav Soloveitchik? He says, we shouldn't quote from his books. And I know in Teaneck they organized a boycott of his Ashkacha. But even not him, he says, we can't, despite the fact that the Rambam says you have to treat these people that way, he says, today, his attitude basically was, today, let the Gedolim fight it out. We should respect everyone. Half, okay, you're right. Well, because every group is going to be, it's like in southern France, the people who put the Rambam's works in Chayrim were then themselves put in Chayrim by the supporters of the Rambam. So everyone was in Chayrim, either because you were put in Chayrim by the southerners or because you studied philosophy and the northerners put you in Chayrim. So Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin is asked this question. What to do about the Satmar Rebbe? The Satmar Rebbe referred to Rav Kook as an apikoros. Of course, yeah, and in Ibshitz as well. The same thing. So what to do with the Satmar Rebbe? So Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin responds like, it's a long tshuva. He responds just like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Basically, he talks about how great Rav Kook was and quotes all these gedolim who refer to Rav Kook as the great sage. And even though the Satmar Rebbe referred to him so negatively, he says we should follow what the Rambam says to be of those who are degraded, hanel oven, venom olvin, those who are degraded but don't degrade others. He doesn't really deal with the Rambam that says that if someone degrades a Torah sage, you must treat him as someone who's not deserving of respect. He basically says that that's not what we do today. So this is in B'nai Vanim, book 3. It's very interesting. And he also quotes his grandfather, Rav Henkin, saying about the Satmar Rebbe that had we had the Sanhedrin today, he would have been declared a Zakein Mamre, a rebellious elder. And he says that doesn't mean that he's not a tzaddik, and it doesn't mean that he's not a Talmud Chacham. But the fact that the Satmar Rebbe chose to go against what every other great sage said, that means if we had a Sanhedrin, they'd declare him as a rebellious elder. But we don't have a Sanhedrin today, and therefore not. By the way, it wasn't just Zakein Mamre, it wasn't just his views. The Satmar Rebbe led rallies in Washington, D.C., sent his followers in front of the White House to protest the Israeli government. They took out newspaper ads. So he really went to the government and tried to bring pressure from the United States government, from the United Nations, on Israel. And in the years after the Holocaust, the notion of turning to the Goyim to try to force Jews, and the things he was talking about was they were building pools in Jerusalem, and that there was archaeological digs, that was regarded as over the top for so many. But again, the Rebbe himself, none of this concerned him. He wouldn't have cared a bit if Agudas HaRabbanim wanted to put him in Chayrim or anything like that. He settled in Williamsburg, And towards the end of his life, he moved with many of his followers to Kiryas Yoel in Monroe, and he himself would go to Tucson in the winters. Many of you know, I'm sure, about the fights in Kiryas Yoel, either the fights between the two sons wanting to take over the current dynasty, or about educating the children. They opened up a school system there for disabled children, a public school system. If we have time at the end of the session, maybe we'll speak about that. But now I want to speak about the Rebbe's theology, which has had a great deal of impact. Obviously, the Neturei Karta look towards him, but so do mainstream anti-Zionists who have nothing to do with meeting anti-Semites in Iran. In fact, the Satmar came out publicly, newspaper advertisements in their newspapers, against these Neturei Karta types that went to Iran and met with the president. Now, not all Neturei Karta are Satmar or come from Satmar. You have Neturei Karta, you have all sorts of people in Neturei Karta. But in Neturei Karta literature, they're always citing the Satmar Rebbe. And it is true that until they went to Iran, Satmar never criticized them, never came out against them. These people, these Neturei Karta types, are really inside the Satmar community. In Vienna, they finally expelled the children of this freedman from there. But until then, until this year, this guy who was going around the world doing all sorts of terrible stuff, he was part of their community. So these Neturei Karta are in the Satmar community, on the edges of it, but in it. It's only now that they've expelled them. And it remains to be seen whether it's a real expulsion, because apparently the children are still in school. Before we go further, because does anyone have any questions? We only have about five more minutes, then we usually take a few looks off. Okay. Yisrael. Either spoken or writing. We'll get to a little, it's not all din, but as we'll see, for the Satmar Rebbe, what's needed in current era is din, for reasons we'll see right now. First, let me note that the Satmar Rebbe didn't invent anti-Zionism. He's often attacked as this terrible anti-Zionist. He did not invent anti-Zionism. Satmar didn't invent it. When Zionism first began, really with Yehuda Alkali and Swedish Kalischer and then the Chibat Zion in Eastern Europe, it struck a chord with many East European Jews. This was going to take them home. They were suffering in Eastern Europe, and they wanted to go back to the land of Israel. But for Jews who were living in Western Europe, in Germany, in England, and France, the notion that they had some sort of connection to the land of Israel was anathema. And they discounted this. They wanted nothing to do with the land of Israel. Even the Orthodox said that we want nothing to do with rebuilding the land until the Messiah comes. Hirsch has a famous letter to Ratzi Hirsch Kalischer telling him that what you're doing, who wanted to build up the land, what you're doing is a sin. So the non-Orthodox thought that Israel was finished for them forever. The Orthodox said, well, in Messianic days, then we can go back. Until then, our only fatherland is Germany, or if you're in England, France. And we live with our fatherland. And this is a messianic idea, but has no practical implications for us. In fact, Hirsch took very seriously something we're going to talk about next class that's central to the Satmar program, the notion of the three oaths. There's a passage in the Talmud in Ketubot 111a, an agadic passage which says that God put three oaths upon the world, two upon the Jews and one upon the Gentiles. The Jews were made to swear that they will not retake the land by force, or they will not, that's what it says, which we'll see how the Satmar understands it, number one. Number two, they would not rebel against the nations of the world, and the non-Jews were given an oath that they were not to overly oppress the Jews. That is, it's okay to oppress the Jews a bit. As we saw with the Chasam Sofer in class one, a little bit of oppression is a good thing. It shows us that we're in the exile, we're in Golis. Once the Goyim stop oppressing us, then we're part of the society, we assimilate. A little bit of oppression is a good thing, but not too much oppression. So those are the three oaths. And Hirsch took them very seriously. Now, in the early stages, Chibat Zion was a very orthodox idea. The followers were Torah Jews. We have a lot to say about Chibat Zion and the Satmar opposition to Zionism, the theological basis for it, But I see in my clock, at least, it's 10 o'clock, and we usually have a number of questions, so why don't we stop here? As I said, the best is yet to come. As the song says, we've only just begun, because the whole Satmar ideology, which I think many of you will just find, say, outrageous, doesn't begin to talk about it. The Rebbe moves into the realm of the demonic and brings in the whole notion of black magic, responsible for everything that we see in this world. I think you'll find it totally out there, but we'll have to wait till next week to do that. In the meantime, though, any questions so far on what we've done? You'd be surprised. If you live in these communities, they revolve to a large extent on condemnations, on one-upsmanship, on who's a heretic and who's not. There is great chesed. I'll speak about it next class in the Satmar community. You're in a community, but it's no different than other religious communities. Once you're in the community, if you are part of the community, then there's a lot of great things about it. You feel like you belong, there's community, but the boundary is so strong. To get in or get out, in order to keep a community like this going, the outside world must be made so evil and so threatening. This is hardly unique to Satmar. Other Hasidic groups do it. Christian fundamentalist sects do it. That is, you create a wonderful community on the inside, and part of the way you do that is by demonizing the outside. And it's a common theme.
Mark?
Yeah.
It's Frank. Why did they grow more than Belz or Babov or even or Lubavitch? Just
okay, good question. First, Belz was centered in the land of Israel, just like Ger, so all their movement came in Israel. Babov grew too, but you're comparing apples and oranges. The Satmar Rebbe was such a dynamic figure, an uncompromising figure, a great Torah scholar, that people were just drawn to him. Now, you asked a good question about Lubavitch, though. Lubavitch had a great leader, a dynamic, charismatic figure. I think the answer is that Satmar pulled all these Hungarians in. Who survived in Russia from Lubavitch? Most of them were killed, and the ones who weren't killed were stuck in the Soviet Union. So the Rebbe didn't have this pool to work with. The Satmar got all these Hungarians who came over, so you had Hungarians. By the way, the Hungarians, the whole turn to Glock Kosher is a Hungarian phenomenon. They come in and become very influential. In America, it's because Hungary, to a large extent, the people were not killed. That gave the Satmar Rebbe, as the premier Hungarian figure, it left after the Holocaust, the ability to get all these people. He had others. He had Papa, he had Ungvar, but the Satmar, he was able to take this this great pool of people coming from Hungary who joined his community. And people are drawn to extremism. They are drawn, because if you grew up with this, many people rejected it. Halivni grew up with this type of extremist ideology. Elie Wiesel grew up with this. But if many people, this is all they knew, this type of Torah Judaism in which the inside is so warm but the outside is so different. Now, as to Rav Soloveitchik, I only know of one statement that Rav Soloveitchik made about the Williamsburg mentality, that it will never be able to provide answers for the modern Jew. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. But these were just totally different worlds. So obviously the Rav Soloveitchik's attitude to the whole Satmar ideology, I've heard from people who knew the Rav that he just couldn't understand this whole Satmar thing. I mean, that you're going to create a shtetl like Satmar in New York, the whole thing seemed very foreign to him. And that, it is incredible. The shtetl of Satmar with its communal structure, with, I mean, they give all their money into some, they put their money into all these, this giant pot, which is then used to buy properties and everything. The whole thing works in an incredible way. I mean, you ever wonder why no one moves into Kiryas Yoel? You don't have any Hispanics, you don't have anything. They control the town. It's obviously illegal to say we're not going to sell to someone, but they are able to control every single house that comes on the market. I mean, they're able to control things in such an advanced, sophisticated way. They operate just like they did in the shtetl. If you've never been, it's certainly worth a trip to Kiryas Yoel. No, I mean, it wasn't the extremism. He came to America, and he was an extremist. And if you read his memoir, he wouldn't even eat the food which the Mashkiach was one of these Tarvadas or Chambalin guys because he didn't have a beard. And, I mean, he was an extremist, but he's in a new land. And while there, he wants to get an education. You know, he's no longer in the environment. So once you're taken out of the extremist environment with Chambalin, everyone went to college. So he decides, says he wants to go to college, and he records how the Satmar, he records his conversation with Rav Aaron Cutler about this, and I think also with the Satmar Rav. But then he went to Lieberman. He met Lieberman because someone wanted to bring him to speak to him, and he knew nothing about Lieberman, the conservative movement, and that to him was what brought him in. There's no question that many people were driven away from the extremism in Satmar. Some were driven into Zionism. Don't forget, all the Hungarian Zionists came from extremist anti-Zionist households. But the idea that extremist communities can't keep their followers, on the contrary, look at the modern Orthodox has a hard time keeping their young. The Haredim and the Hasidim seem to have, yes, their people will leave. This book by Hillel Winston called The Unchosen speaks about them. But when they're having 8, 9, 10 children, if you lose one child for every 20 or every 10, you still have a lot. The difference is, when the Satmar go off the derech, as they say, and I know some of them, almost invariably you end up seeing them in Greenwich Village with tattoos and long hair. They really go off the derech. There was something in the Village Voice about 5 years ago about these Satmar types who go off the path. And as I said, they're in bands and they're on drugs.
They're extreme in everything they do. They're real extremists.
Okay. They became financially powerful. When I say a collective, I mean they put a lot of their money, they have these ideas that they don't give all their money, but they have their Meister and everything that they give to organizations, so they buy things. It also helps them, to speak frankly, with certain tax things. They have certain shady things going on. Speak to any Satmar, they'll tell you. But Satmar Rebbe gave brachas, and many of the Satmar Hasidim became very wealthy. They're not Litvisha people here. They believe in working. They all go out and work. I don't just mean the photo of 42nd Street photo. Many of them are involved in various businesses, and you have a number of extremely wealthy Satmar figures, and they attribute it to the bracha of the Rebbe, and they've been able to support it. Half the people going to these Satmar schools are on scholarships. They go to camps on scholarship. Remember, in the Satmar community, you then go to camp, which is basically Torah learning for the most part in the mountains, but many of these people can't afford it. School for them is tuition is a couple thousand dollars for a year. Compare that to our tuitions. It is heavily subsidized by wealthy, we're not talking about 5 or 10, we're talking about hundreds of very wealthy people who are huge Baalei Tzedakah, giving money to keep the Satmar community afloat. They're very wealthy. When I was in Vienna, I heard about some very wealthy Satmar. They're very wealthy in Antwerp. They're very wealthy. What can we say? They're good at business. Okay, we have time for another couple questions. They learn Torah. Next class, we'll talk about their major sefer, the equivalent to the Tanya, which is this book by Yoel Moshe. But they learn. They're Talmidei Chachamim. They're not like some of these Polish Hasidic groups that are not great learners. They're Talmidei Chachamim. They learn Gemara. They learn Chumash, obviously, and they learn Hungarian Hasidus and Chasam Sofer, Drashas. They learn. You'll find them even in Lakewood, some of them. They weren't Tzak, though. They're not learning Gemara. They're not learning Talmud like they do in Lithuanian yeshivas. There are many great poskim in the Satmar world. In the Hungarian approach, the Hungarian derech was always to focus on Gemara, learn through the Beis Yosef, and practical halacha. None of these brisker chakiros or anything of that nature. They're all into learning for practical halacha. And there is no question about it. There are many great Talmid HaChachamim, poskim, muvhakim, great poskim in the Satmar world. We might not like their ideology, but their sfarim are top of the line, first rate. Okay, well, let's hold this question about involving yourself until next class. Yes, they considered you Jewish. If you went to their shul, they would count you in a minyan. I went undercover once to the Satmar shul in Borough Park next to the Bubba Rishmesh. I was invited back to someone's house. When I say I went undercover, I made it seem like I was just some guy I didn't know anything. The bark is worse than the bite. So they do not regard you all as heretics, which is the irony, because we all should be heretics, because we all believe in heresy. We'll see a very interesting thing, that the Satmar have this notion of you can believe in heresy but not be a heretic. So we all believe in kafira. I dare say everyone listening here is moda to avodah zara, not just kafira, literally idolatry. And yet that doesn't mean that they regard us as idolaters. Yes, our rabbis, our rebbes, they're the real heretics, but we're just misled by them. So we believe in heresy, but I guarantee you, and I tell you, I have many friends in the Satmar community. They do not regard us as evil or wicked people. So we'll pick up. But that really speaks to this whole double approach of the Satmar Rebbe: condemn the sinner, the sin, but not the sinners. So we will pick up next class, and where we'll conclude about the great Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum. Good night, everyone.
Thanks. Thank you, Mark. Okay, good night, everybody. And we'll look forward to seeing you next week, you and one of your friends.
Any Satmar in Toronto?
Yes, there's a Satmar Shtiebel. I think has a Satmar meaning Shtiebel 500 from where I live. It's the only Shtiebel in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been there for the first time in my life, Friday night on Pesach. There's whatever, let's say about 5 million. The rabbi came over to me. I think he saw for Shalom, am I right? That he has such a meaning. He came over, said hello to me. You know, the people who come there are not at all. It's not at all a Hasidic minion. But
Ask the Rav there to speak at Torah and Moshe. He probably would. Okay.
Okay,
good night.
Good night, thanks. Okay, have a good night, everybody.
Mark Bistricher? Do I know a Mark Bistricher?
He's from Toronto, and he just, Mark, are you online? Say hi to Mark.
It says
hi, can you hear me?
Yeah. Oh, so we have a Satmar in the class? Is that true, with a name like Mark?
Mark, we can hear you. Why don't you speak up again? Transmit and we'll listen.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm Satmar. My grandfather was a very good friend of the Satmar Rebbe. My father grew up Satmar. We didn't wear any of the official garb or the gartel or anything like that. And, we're kind of disappointed what's going on in the current Satmar community, but it really is a fascinating thing to be a part of.
But when you say you're Satmar, with a name like Mark, but still, I mean, you Satmar in terms of a real member of the community? Ideologically?
I would call myself as such. Cringe when I see Neturei Karta, but I hardly call myself a Zionist.
Okay,
my real name is Mordechai Yehuda.
Okay, well, good. Then it's great. And by the way, you speak English. Most of the Satmar I know, but so it'll be great to have you where you can offer your insight. I will say it's interesting that this notion, there used to be Hasidim who were clean-shaven and wore regular clothes. You don't have that phenomenon anymore. But in the 1950s and 1960s, it was this last generation of people who went to various Hasidic rebbes and regard themselves as Hasidim but didn't wear the garb. So it's a sort of a lost generation of Hasidim. But I'm glad to have at least someone on the inside. You can tell me if you agree or disagree with some of the things I'll say next class, or even clarify some of the ideas, because I'm obviously an outsider, although I do have many contacts and I've read all the Svarim that I can get my hands on. So I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll see you. Mirz Hashem, hope you'll be with us next week too, and as we continue.
I most definitely will.